Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of People on the Move, a podcast by Cargomatic. I'm Weston Labar, and here with us today is Carl Bensel, Federal Maritime Commissioner, who's got a lot going on and a lot of great updates for us today. But Carl, you've been a friend of the industry, friend of the show here, and tell our listeners a little bit about who you are if they don't know already.
Sure. I've been doing maritime and transportation issues for a long time, probably too long, but started on Capitol Hill as a maritime counsel back in the House of Representatives, also worked in the U.S. Senate as the primary counsel, senior counsel for the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. So got a lot of exposure to maritime shipping, railroads, trucking issues, worked in the private sector with various associations and various transportation companies. And so I was put back in by President Trump as a commissioner at the Federal Maritime Commission. So I was nominated and had to go through the process of getting that nomination approved at the U.S. Senate and have been there since 2019, excuse me. And I've got a 5-year term with a 2 years carryover, and we're like most independent agencies. We have 5 commissioners, and basically we adjudicate a lot of the disputes between the transportation industries engaged in supply chain movement. So I've known you for a long time, and we've worked on a lot of trucking issues, a lot of port issues, and so looking forward to talking to your audience today.
Yeah, and you hit the ground running. I mean, 2019, you rolled up your sleeves, and let's just be honest, the last several years have maybe been the most active years for the FMC since the 80s, right? And you've got a really great group of commissioners that understand the industry, led by Chairman Maffei, who really wanted to not just be a board, but to be a board that was going to invoke its ability to make an imprint on the industry. And obviously, we'll talk through some of this, like OSRA and some of the other hallmark legislation that's recently come out. But the newest news, the biggest news, is you've published the report on the MTDI. Talk a little bit about the work that went into that, the different conclusions that were drawn, because this has been a major undertaking for you for the last several years.
It has, and I appreciate your contributions as well, and the industry in general. We actually wanted to talk to the people who are engaged in the movement of cargo and know what it's like and what their perceptions were. But I talked to Chairman Maffei. We both felt that the quality of information that was imparted through the movement of cargo during the supply chain movement was substandard, wasn't where it should be. And so we wanted to do an assessment, and that assessment was the Maritime Transportation Data Initiative. So we had meetings every week, an hour, and we asked the same questions to all of the participants. What sort of information do you have? What sort of information would you like to receive in terms of your business operations? What's the form and content of that information? Is there a distinction between import and export? And so we wanted to hear the same base questions answered by every segment of the industry. So trucking, drayage trucking, ocean carriers, longshoremen, terminal operators, large integrators, distribution hubs, shipping lines. So we pretty much gauged, we got an assessment from all of the different parties about where we were with respect to that. And our initiative was designed to come up with a common lexicon to describe how movement could be described, and also to recommend standards going forward for harmonization of data, of maritime data. And so we completed it. We had a summit. Staff, the FMC staff took in all of these recommendations, and we came out with a report, which I shared with the industry. I took some additional comments, and you referenced the report, and so we have a report with recommendations which call for the establishment of the Maritime Transportation Data System going forward. And boiled down to its most simple description, it would require a real-time, it would require ocean carriers to make publicly available information related to their services coming into and out of the country in advance of their service, real-time in-transit visibility as they move cargo, and requirements for them to update when they anticipate arriving at U.S. Ports, harmonizing the process of getting access into marine terminals, standardizing terminology on in terms of the description of what a shipper should expect to know, or a trucker, about cargo while in the terminal, and extending that to railroad cargoes, intermodal railroad cargoes, as part of a subcontract through contract. And I believe these are the first standards in the world to try to achieve this.
And timely as well. You know, you really did a few things as you had to set the stage for what the ultimate findings were going to be. And as you know, the issue in our industry isn't a lack of data. It's a lack of data sharing. It's a lack of data integrity. Is the data good? Can we communicate? And one of the first things you talked about was bringing some uniformity to how we communicate. I mean, I know Commissioner Dye dove into that as she looked at detention and demurrage, because it was detention, it was per diem, it was all these different things. So in our industry, we live in acronyms. And when you start to talk about data, well, an ERD means one thing to an exporter, and it means something completely different to an intermodal shipper, right? And when I first got in this industry, I think that was the hardest thing, is everybody had different terminology for the same thing, and figuring out when were they talking about the same thing versus when were they talking about different things. That was the very first part of this, but identifying common language, identifying the ability for folks to communicate cross-sector, cross-vertical, cross-company, right? Because we all have our own internal vernacular that we use at every single private sector participant in the supply chain. And then also, you know, you've got these major ports now. You've got the Port of Los Angeles with the Port Optimizer that Gene Siroc has been championing for years, probably the first port to take an initiative like that and run with it. Then you had the Port of Long Beach with the information highway. You've got a number of ports that are looking at different portals and different ways to share information. And this has been one of the struggles, is how do we ingest that data and democratize it for folks to be able to get access to it, to better have operations. And really what you've done is, and tell me if this was the intent, but you were setting the ground rules. You're trying to say, if you play by these rules, we'll be able to advance. And we're at a point in our industry where if you're not a technology company, whether you're a trucking company, a shipping company, an importer, an exporter, you're probably not going to be very good at what you do for much longer, because you need to be able to eliminate those blind handoffs that cause so much of the delays and increased costs.
Yeah, I think you described it pretty well. I mean, we're advocating a performance standard on information and on the quality of information. It's not just that you get information, it's when you get information. Mm-hmm. So if you're arriving at a terminal and you have no container with you, and they're requiring dual use transactions that day, you wait in line and you get there and you find out that you've waited in vain. This information has to be made available the day before, you know, at 12 p.m. So people need to know what the operating posture is. So it's not, you're right, there was lots of information. And so it's harnessing this information the right way, so to provide it in a better platform, so that it's useful. I found that there was a lot of difference between, for instance, a large shipper, a Walmart, and a Target, and the information they got from their ocean carriers on the status of their cargo than maybe others would get. But there was sort of a dislocation between the sales force, the people that would talk to to the shippers and the truckers that were delivering cargo ultimately, what was happening operationally. Ocean Carrier, for instance, would provide information about a terminal, and they wouldn't know what was happening at the terminal. So we need to sort of create a set of groundwork. I say I'm maybe the first one, if you think of it as a football stadium, I put the outlines of a field there. There's still a lot of room in terms of how you fill in the lines in between the field, but it would set the framework on what is required for the dissemination of information. And we really, you know, in my report, I always say this, it's like when you order a Domino's pizza, you know when your order's been received, you know when it's taken out of the oven, you know when who your driver is, you can see them moving towards you, and they arrive and they usually take a picture of the arrival pizza on your doorstep. But we're talking millions of dollars of cargo, and we have no sense of when it might arrive or what ships are going to be providing service 3 months from now. Think about trying to get a ticket to Walt Disney for your children 5 months from now. If you're in the maritime environment, you just couldn't do it. There's no information about what that is that's publicly accessible. So we have to get there. And you're right, it's not a prescriptive set of requirements. It's rather standards for information, performance standards. So the industry, companies like yours can fill in the dots with better data.
Absolutely. And that's the game changer, right? The industry is extremely fragmented. Many years ago, a lot of folks combated that with vertical integration, and some are attempting that again, but virtual integration, the ability for multiple service providers, multiple vendors, multiple key contributors to the supply and distribution chain, being able to share information for the end user as if it's one experience is really where we need to get to from the industry's perspective. And these all have rolled up, right? What you've done with MTDI, and then obviously detention demurrage, and the chairman did a great job of working with individual commissioners, and it all rolls up to the largest piece of legislation our industry's seen probably since the original Shipping Act, which is the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. And I know that the Federal Maritime Commission during COVID, and I want to just preface this by saying the issues that people experienced during COVID were not new. They were the same issues that the industry and shippers have experienced on and off again anytime there's been an increase in volume or a decrease in capacity for decades. However, COVID, like it did with so many things, it created a more sustained period of pain, I guess is the best way to put it. And don't let a good crisis go to waste. And now the FMC through OSRA is poised to become an even bigger participant in how we regulate the supply chain. I think for many years, the commission was an afterthought. Well, that's definitely not the case anymore. Talk a little bit about that, what that change has been like before we really hop into OSRA, because there's going to be some trailing legislation that's been introduced that's going to look at the powers of the FMC. Talk a little bit about what that's like, because no longer do I consider the FMC the quote unquote paper tiger. You guys are growing claws and teeth.
Well, I appreciate that. Makes me feel good. I think it was really apparent to all of the commissioners. And as you said, I think actually fact finding 28, Commissioner Dye started talking about the quality of data. So these are issues that the Hanjin bankruptcy and labor issues related to contract negotiations. And it pops up periodically all the time. And we're right on the cusp of being able to, it's so many players and actors involved, and there's so much cargo. During the pandemic, we saw a 27% increase in containerized cargo. The administration passed the CARES Act, and in that act, they gave the transit and aviation industries $128 billion. And about 10% of those people remained on the job for the next 2 years. The maritime industry, the affiliated trucking and railroad industries continued to work through COVID, and really were critically important in our economy and our essential economy. And it really makes you realize after you see inflation, and you know inflation is being triggered by some of the failures, the challenges that we had with congestion. And I don't really blame the industry per se on it. It was a 27% increase of cargo. And I don't think that the government was doing what it needed to do to help sustain this industry, our industry, during that time. So it made me realize we really have to probably take a more aggressive posture. And I'm personally not one who's a huge fan of, you know, overt regulation. I prefer to let the industry work it out. So I think in this case, the data issue to me was something that was such a big issue that could be resolved. And we could do it in a way that would rely on the industry to implement the changes and use their data more effectively, that it was necessary to make the recommendation that will be considered by the commission to establish federal standards in this area. So, and I think everyone that works at the FMC, I mean, it's happened before, but we saw what happened to our economy, to the people. So on one hand, it's great that truckers continue to work through the pandemic and provide service from ports, and ocean carriers were carrying record loads, and longshoremen and railroads were moving cargo effectively, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for what we needed. And so that's why you said we're right on the cusp all the time. And so we need to probably do something to harmonize here. I'm not going to ask for any new data. I'm just going to ask people to use their information more effectively. So that's what the recommendation is. And I think everybody at my agency realizes how important the freight movement industry is. And so we have taken a more aggressive posture to work with the industry to make sure some of these malpractices and problematic issues can be more effectively addressed.
Yeah. And I may be a little bit biased, but I always say that we are the most essential industry because all the other industries rely on us to be able to do what they need to do. And during COVID, healthcare workers, they were the heroes of our nation. But if it wasn't for the supply chain, if it wasn't for truckers, if it wasn't for warehouse workers, if it wasn't for the shippers and the railroads, they wouldn't have had the PPE. They wouldn't have had the vaccines. They wouldn't have had all the things that they need to do their job. And so no matter what you're doing, whether you're going to the hospital or whether you're going to the store, the underpinning fabric of our entire economy is the supply chain. And the majority of our goods in this nation come in and out of our borders, right? And so it shows the real importance the FMC has in globalization and maintaining fair and equitable standards in this industry. And, you know, that's honestly, from a large perspective, what OSER was supposed to do: reevaluate the industry. We hadn't had any major legislation since the late 90s that even addressed how the industry worked. Again, the Shipping Act, 1980s, was the last time we really had a major piece of legislation. And here we go, you know, some 30 plus years later, getting the opportunity to reassess it. From your perspective, and I'm not going to say, hey, from the FMC's perspective, but right, from Commissioner Carl Bensel's perspective, what are the top three things that you're hoping to get out of OSRA as it relates to bringing a better platform for the industry and creating that equity? Because at the end of the day, if all the parties are able to operate where they're making money when freight moves, the general public, the American economy, the American consumer wins.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember before I get into your question, you were talking about the essential character of the industries and behind the scenes during the pandemic. I remember having to make calls to Gene Scirocca and Mario Cordero, telling them that I'm hearing from people who are shipping ventilators that they need help trying to get them in. And I talked to them, and they talked to their carriers, and people tried to to help out, you know, and really, you're right. It was essential. So, you know, I think because of the challenge, and the challenge was created because that volume was so, what we went from 20% down, you remember, I think I wrote a letter to the president of the United States saying, urging him to assist the industry in terms of lease payments, because cargo volumes had gone down about 20%. And that was in the early part, I think, you know, January, February, March, April. And then by June, Chinese manufacturing had reopened, and we went from 20% down to a 30% increase, so a 50% swing. And as you recall, there wasn't enough chassis, there wasn't enough for what we needed to do. And we went from one or two vessels waiting offshore to 100 to 150 vessels around the nation waiting sometimes up to 2 weeks to get serviced. So prices went up, you know, the prices went from $2,500 to spot rates that were $30,000. And the duration for a transit took from 1 month or 35 days to 3 months. And so that meant that there was less capacity to address the need. So it was supply and demand. And so I think what ASRA is reflective of is the need to reevaluate everything in the industry to make sure there are not impediments that are unreasonable impediments to allow the industry to provide service to require. It's a requirement for common carriage. You know, we said as a condition to providing service in the United States, it means once you put your light on, you're servicing all. Fairly, and everyone has an opportunity. So we saw challenges. For instance, on the import level, the rates were so high that I think it's clear that ocean carriers were focused on delivering imports and probably disregarded the opportunity to do exports during that time, and it had a consequence on exporters. So we have to come up with, you know, a couple of changes, tweaks to reassess what should be done, what's reasonable. Our standard is a reasonableness standard, and mm-hmm. what's reasonable to me may be different from Chairman Maffei or Commissioner Vakich or Commissioner Solar or Commissioner Dye. So it's an iterative process that you have to engaged. And so we need to continue to look at the legal issues that are brought to us, to provide guidance on what's reasonable. And it has to be done in the context of what's reality now and what's happening. So I think we've been consciously trying to look at the trucking industry and the services that are provided by drayage trucking to make sure that we're not driving people from that industry. Because if you don't have wheels, you don't drive. You don't deliver containerized cargo. So
yeah, well, and you know, I sit here most days in California, where typically when there's any sort of policy around our industry, it's not good news for those that are trying to move the freight. And it's great seeing the attention that the industry got in a positive way, but really at the federal level, and having a big brother that really understands the industry in Washington, D.C., that's the role the FMC has the opportunity to play and to be that standard bearer, to be that equity setter by continuously just understanding what's going on in the industry and how the industry needs to evolve from a policy perspective based on operationally what's going on. Because too often we've done the set it and forget it. And then we focus on things like air quality, labor standards, other things, all important stuff. But if you can't operate a successful business, none of that stuff really even matters. And you touched quickly on exporters. And, you know, we like to say if you bought it, a trucker brought it. And that's true for exports. And it's something I know Cargomatic is getting more and more engaged in. You know, we recently hired Ed Aldridge as our president when he was at CMA CGM North America. He was a very, maybe, you know, regarded as the most friendly shipper to American exporters, and obviously the largest steamship line in the Trans-Pacific trade route. Talk a little bit, just briefly, about what ASRA means for exporters, because, you know, Peter Friedman at the AGPC and so many other champions, Peter's the loudest of all of them, and in a good way, but, you know, oftentimes when we talk about ports, we think imports. But here in America, we need to think about exports if we want to have fair and balanced trade. And exports have they're growing at a time when imports have waned, exports are increasing. So talk a little bit about what that means, because if we make it here, but we can't ship it someplace else, that really hurts our whole economy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you know, first of all, I'm glad Ed Aldridge is a good man and a friend, and he came to me and talked often during the pandemic about efforts that they were trying to do with CMA CGM. So I'm glad to hear he's with you. For a port to be most effective, they want a 50-50 trade. You want to take a container on and put another one off. And even if the values are different for that port, it doesn't matter because they get paid the same based on just the movement of the box, essentially. And from a perspective of the national economy, I want our businesses to do well, and that means our exports to thrive. They tend to be a different type from manufactured goods, which tend to come, unfortunately, in my view, always from China and Asia into the United States, as opposed to the vice versa. And so they tend to be agriculture and bulk commodity and different odds and ends that probably don't have the value. So it's difficult, and it's a little bit more difficult to deal with them, because if prices for crops are high, everyone wants to sell. And so this imbalance is a difficult challenge. And that's where information going forward, how to marshal assets effectively. I'm a big proponent of shippers associations going forward, because I think the shippers associations were established in the 84 Act to allow shippers to get together to negotiate contracts, but they can also be used. And I was met with a wine and shippers association to do affiliated things as well to serve a particular trade or a particular region or area. So I think that sort of some of the stuff that you're looking at is really important on providing access to the supply chain moving forward. So it's something I think that we need to, I'm a regulatory agency, but I will tell you, I always look at what's a better form of business for the benefit of the whole. I think we need to continually look at that and praise it when it's working. But we need to continually work to do exports because of the nature of the differences between the consumer demand and the competition.
Yeah, and you brought up associations, and obviously we all know shippers associations help as nonprofits move things, but there's other associations, there's trade associations, right? And I've spent a large part of my career either running them or now sitting on their boards. There's one that runs the Uniform Intermodal Interchange Agreement. Obviously it rolls up under IANA. The UIIA has been at the center of a lot of these discussions as it relates to OSRA, as it relates to all the way back to fact-finding 28 and the realization that detention and demurrage needed to be looked at. Talk a little bit, because you were penned a very strongly worded letter to Joni Casey, who is the CEO of IANA, with some of your colleagues, talking about the role of the UIIA as it pertains to, let's just say, the new landscape for this industry and what OSRA is going to bring. Talk a little bit about that letter and then what you've seen as it relates to the UIIA fitting into the fabric of what we currently have with OSRA before we hop into the next steps for OSRA.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting, it was created actually by the Department of Transportation. I think the Maritime Administration first came up with a way of harmonizing the interchange between trucking and intermodal cargo. So the federal government engaged in the first effort to coordinate that. And I think there's some value in general. If there was a negotiation of every single transaction on the trucking side, there would be be impossible, frankly. However, the agreement transferred to IANA, and I think that they have, you know, they've set up a mechanism to do this, and I hope that that mechanism allows all of the parties to the transactions to participate in how the agreement should be modified and utilized to be fair. And I think I'm going to be honest. I think trucking is usually the short end of the stick on this.
I call it the redheaded stepchild of the industry for obvious reasons.
They tend to be more diffuse and they don't have as much cargo volume. And so that's the challenge. But the industry, both the railroad and the maritime industry, rely completely on those trucking assets. There's no way in most cases just to get cargo to any place without having a trucking. So the provision of intermodal chassis and drayage trucking is a necessary requirement. So my point, I've worked closely with Joni and IANA before, and she did, she indicated that, you know, they were fully prepared to comply with any federal requirements and would change the agreement. But as we move forward implementing OSRA, we will be making some judgments on what's fair and reasonable in the context of detention and demurrage and providing more guidance. And so that agreement can't be out of sync with what the Federal Maritime Commission is proposing for standards in this area. So, she was very supportive of, continuing to monitor and ensure. If you have that situation, this is just going to be a legal nightmare, because you have a document that's used for almost every contract of carriage and competing precedent and law and guidance from a federal agency. And so we need to avoid that. And I think we will. So I hope going forward that we'll keep that in harmony.
Yeah, the intent of the UIIA, right? The purpose behind it is paramount. What it does to help the industry is potentially second to none when you're starting to talk about the administrative burden it would create if it went away. Getting it harmonized with whatever the final version of OSRA takes form with, as we now have two competing bills that will help define what the ultimate outcome looks like from a who's going to have different powers from a regulatory standpoint. What powers are they going to have? You've got a very important deadline coming up. I know that was outlined in the first bill that was passed last year. But having the UIA work with in harmony with that legislation, I think is so crucial to the industry, because let's just be honest, the alternative doesn't look any better than having a version of the UIIA that we have today. It's got to work. And that brings us to maybe the fundamental next steps, the biggest questions, which is you've got competing bills that do different things now to take OSRA to the next level. Talk a little bit about, you've got the Garamundi bill out there, and obviously he was a co-author of the first one with Dusty Johnson. Talk a little bit about what's on the table, right? And from your perspective, if you can, from a broader agency perspective, what do the two bills mean to the FMC? What do the two bills mean to the industry? And, if there's anything that you can say, maybe it's more of a what you like about both or what you don't like about both, as opposed to one over the other. But, what do you think is the main message that this is going to convey once all said and done?
So, I mean, there's always some controversy about the antitrust immunity that the ocean carriers have. And I've been working in this industry a long time, and it's how it's utilized now has changed completely. Used to be a price sharing setting function. Now the agreements are primarily space sharing allocations, so that you get more alternatives as a shipper And so we don't have those sort of competitive issues on pricing. What we do have, though, on the other hand, is we've had a consolidation of the industry, a greater consolidation. So under the antitrust laws, the competition laws that they're advocating to be applied, which do apply to mergers on ocean carriers, we've seen the ocean carrier industry servicing the United States go from 32 to 16. There's 16 mergers, and now there's 9 major carriers providing international services. So there has been consolidation under our competition policies already, and we're left with 9. The FMC approach is that if you do an agreement, we have to review it, and we continue to monitor those agreements all the time. So the alliance agreements that people are questioning, we have operating information from them on a quarterly basis, on a monthly basis. We have information related to their pricing, so we can continue to exercise jurisdiction over those practices. And as I said, on the carrier side, they're mostly agreements to share space. Where you're seeing a lot of agreements now is on the port side, chassis sharing and clean truck programs and pier pass, and these are sort of because of the sheer volume of actors and players involved that they need to coordinate policies for services and environmental compliance. So I think if you saw the elimination of the antitrust immunity, you would see even more consolidation. You'd see some winners and losers at port levels. I don't know what this would mean in a port like Oakland or other ports, which may stand to lose a major player at one of their terminals. And so the port industry just doesn't want to deal with a lot of change in the structure of business or consolidation further. So I'm opposed to anything that would transfer our authority over agreements. I have made recommendations on the Hill with Commissioner Vekage to affirmatively have more authority to evaluate agreements and approve them and disapprove them. Right now, we have to go to court to challenge them, and so I think there's some changes there. I was really happy that Congressman Garamendi and Johnston included some language on implementing the maritime data information system requirements. So we work with them. I like to talk about all of these issues all the time. I don't think there's anything wrong with legislation on maritime and talking these issues out on the merits. So I'm happy that they're paying attention, and I'm going to go in and meet with them next week and just talk generally about issues that are going on. And I think it's critical to always assess that. But my view is the destabilizing effect of eliminating antitrust immunity would be severe and would drive further consolidation. And we do, given the nature and the direction of the industry, a lot of these agreements have value environmentally or for cooperative purposes. And I think that there will be even more of those. I honestly think we should give some of the trucking industry more access into these agreements as they're established to make sure that their views are considered as they implement these cooperative policies. But that's my position on that.
And the role of the terminal operator vis-a-vis being the landside extension of the ocean carrier, right? It's an ecosystem. It's a network. And that would be, at my time at the Harbor Trucking Association, one of the big callouts we had was the fact that the terminal operator was nowhere to be mentioned in something like the UIIA, right? And so you're missing one of the most important stakeholders. And just to double down for our listeners that don't know, many people may think that Federal Maritime Commission, when these alliances or mergers or acquisitions or anything is coming to the table, may think the FMC can say thumbs up, thumbs down. And as you iterated, actually, you have a review period and then you have to challenge it in court if you disagree with it. So it basically has a path to being approved without much friction. But if there's a concern, you have to go through the court system to actually stop these agreements from going through. It's not your traditional thumbs up, thumbs down process that that many other regulators get the opportunity to follow.
I would say most every regulator has the ability to approve or disapprove something. And so, yes, it is, you know, it went back. And when we did this was the 84 Act, and a lot of the agreements were price agreements, and they took a lot more time to review it. Now, by virtue of what's going on, that's really departed. And I think the wave of the future will be more of these shoreside agreements. When I started doing this, the ocean carriers own the terminals. They own their own equipment, chassis, and they owned shipping coming in. And now, as you say, in like L.A. Long Beach, which is incredible. It's in my view one of the most complex and dynamic port environments in the world. And you know, I was in Antwerp and Rotterdam and visiting with their folks. But we have more complexity of system and more players and more actors. And you know, shippers are setting up distribution centers, and those need to be catered to. And so it's really a challenge. And so we need to set up a mechanism so that the industry, you know, I've always, you know, I go to some of the propeller club meetings around the country, and it's always nice to see that truckers are there and harbor trucking, and sometimes you get the railroads even to come in. And but that's what you need. You need that sort of cooperative grouping between all parties to explain what their position is and how to more effectively move cargo.
Absolutely. One final question, and you've been so great here with us today. Get your crystal ball out, because you've covered a lot of different things. This is going to be even more of an inflection point for our industry, because now that the dust has settled a little bit on the chaos that has been the last couple of years, many of the industry participants are looking at how do they retool, reinvest, what do they need to do to prepare so these same issues don't happen the next time around, and there will be a next time around. You've got labor contracts that have been finalized, like the railroad. You've got other ones that are still under negotiation, like the ILWPMA. You've got the largest shipping alliance in the world announcing it's going to split. I could go on, but yeah. There's so many major things happening in the industry. And then on top of it all, we're looking at the public policy that drives the industry, at least here in the United States, in a different way. And how do all these different contributing factors get dealt with from a policy perspective, from an infrastructure investment perspective? Again, we need to keep being the squeaky wheel in Washington, D.C. and state capitals throughout the United States, because we're all in the freight industry. We're all in the business of moving something from someplace to someplace else. And so what does your crystal ball say? We're here at the end of 2023. Where does the dust really settle? What do you think is going to happen? What do you think are the major opportunities we can't fall on our sword regarding this before the end of the year?
So, you know, I'm bullish on the industry. I think the consumers in the United States are used to, I think the Fed is raising interest rates in the hopes that people will say it's, you know, it's too expensive to buy, continue to buy things, and I don't want to carry so much debt. But I think people are used to having things any time they want to. And if it's just a little $2 product, it's now being delivered directly to your house all the time. I go out in my front porch and there's three little packages, and I have a teenage daughter. So I don't even know how they get there.
Transportation costs more than the actual widget half the time.
That's right. So I am, and manufacturing, I was with the construction industry roundtable and they supply all of their components all throughout the world, and their suppliers have supply all. So and containerization is going to continue to expand. I think bulk shipping will decrease in presence, and containerized shipping will become more and more important as industrialized, as nations, developing nations become more industrialized and more acclimated to containerized service. So I think there will be just a continual pattern of growth, even though it may go up and down like we've seen. And we've seen a period of time, last couple of months, where volumes have gone down on the West Coast because of the negotiations. Also, people, the shippers have gone from just-in-time delivery to just-in-case delivery, and they built up a cargo in certain areas. And I think that that will even out, and you're going to see growth. You're going to see a return of the industry. And I think the challenge, crystal ball part, going forward, there's not enough room at U.S. ports. And so we're going to have to be more efficient. We're going to have to look at alternatives. So if I was LA and Long Beach, I would be looking at inland rail express services to get to certain areas where you can handle it. I would be looking at smaller ports, Port Hueneme and Everett and other alternatives that could be that could provide adjustments. I think suppliers are going to have to really hone in. It used to be that a CEO would never even consider issues like the supply chain. And now they are. And it's because they may have lost 15 or 20% of their business opportunities during the pandemic because they couldn't get everything that they needed. And I visited with the in Salt Lake City with the home builders. And they said in 2021, this always sticks in my head, that they had planned to build 205,000 residential units in that region. One of the builders, I think, was the largest builder. But they'd only been able to complete 140,000 units at the end of the year because they couldn't get all of those components that go into it. So that need to deliver all of those things will drive us. So data, this is an answer on how we can try to coordinate to more effectively disperse cargo through the country using big ports, alternative ports, hopefully container on barge at some point in the United States, so that the big ports that have river access could use that as an alternative. So I think it's going to rise all boats, all through the transportation industry. Hopefully the railroads will get it together and start investing in intermodal services. The trucking industry can be serviced the right way in terms of getting stuff in and out. So, drivers need to drive. And they need to drive, and they can't wait. And so you got to set up a system that's going to be attractive to allow them to drive. So I think that will be the continuing pressure as how we look at alternatives and use technology and get partnerships with suppliers to create greater visibility going forward. But that the demand will be a continual driving factor. Even though there is money in the infrastructure bills for something, think about how long it took to get the Alameda corridor running. So you're really talking a big 10-year project, for some of these major projects. So I think we should be focused on technology, information, and getting enhancements there, cooperative working arrangements, but your port there is just stunning when you go out there. It's six levels high, 60 feet high, and it goes for miles, and that's a lot of cargo.
It's for those of us who are freight nerds, it's more interesting than Disneyland, that's for
it,
sure.
It is. I give this last one before we run out of time. One ship unloading 24,000 TEU ship. The first a truckload of cargo would be entering Las Vegas before the last one was taken off the ship. And so that's a line of trucks from Las Vegas to, and that's one ship.
Yeah.
And there could be 12 or 14 there.
It's the innovation happening in this industry it's so interesting to watch, especially spending the last decade in this industry. I'm very excited and proud to be part of a company like Cargomatic that wants to be the tip of the innovation spear and continue to figure out better and faster and more efficient ways to deliver that cargo. And, you know, I share your optimism. I think that we continue to move things forward. We continue to make things better. We've got to learn from the lessons that were very painful over the last couple of years and make sure incrementally they don't happen again. We've got to move freight and we've got to do it efficiently. And a lot of the work that you are doing in the FMC as a whole around data, around policy is what's going to help industry, private sector participants like Cargomatic move things forward, that needle forward. And that's really the role of government, right? Is to help the private sector fix problems and create jobs. And I'm happy to say that we're doing both of those. So your optimism's shared.
Yeah. And, you know, I would say the right on, you're correct. The industry has to come up with the solutions here. We can set some frameworks. I was in the port of Rotterdam. They've set up companies similar to the Optimizer to sort of manage the different terminals. And they say they spend about a quarter of their time and their personnel just chasing information to put it in so that they can start to work. Well, that's one quarter of your productivity designed to get something that should be easily accessible in this day and age. You know, we're talking across country, me in Washington, you in LA, or Long Beach. I don't know where you
are. I'm in Long Beach. I can walk outside. I can see ships. I can see cranes. So
we should be able to overcome these problems. You know, you have to know when a ship is going to come into berth and have an expectation that these are the volumes that are coming there, and that there is services 3 months out that you could use to ship cargo all around the world. It's just too important not to. So I want to set up a framework that will help allow the industry itself to come up with solutions for maximizing that information.
Yeah, well, Commissioner, thank you again for joining us. You know, just a couple quick things. April, all the freight indexes showed that we were trending upward. So I agree that maybe the second half of this year is going to be an opportunity to have these Phoenix rising from the ashes moments. And hopefully we prove to the world that we've learned our lessons. Data, thank you for everything you're doing on that as a company who provides for free our customers end-to-end visibility from the on-the-water report all the way through the life cycle of that shipment and container. Having really great champions for data and digital infrastructure in Washington, D.C. and throughout the nation are so important. So from everybody at Cargomatic, thank you for the work that you've been doing. Can't wait to have you on again in the future after some of these major initiatives play out. And we have the chance to kind of see where the cards fall and what are the next steps, because this is a journey that never ends.
Yeah, no, I mean, the next step will be putting out that report for comments. So I look forward to reading something from Cargomatic on what their suggestions are. But we're just starting down this path, and I think it's critical to get something done. I want to get something done in this area. So we'll be back in touch, and hopefully then we'll be in a different posture talking about getting closer to the finish line. This just too important not to do.
We're reviewing it as we speak, and do expect some comments from the Cargomatic team as it relates to your report on data and information. So I want to thank you again. I'm Weston Labar. This has been another episode of People on the Move with Federal Maritime Commissioner Carl Bentzel. Thank you again, and have a great day.